Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 23rd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writer from the New Republic, Osita Wanevu, and then just guy who apparently is still in his apartment, Andy Kindler, will be joining us. Meanwhile, COVID hospitalizations of 65-year-olds and over Americans plunge in the wake of having over 50% of the country vaccinated, at least one vaccination. Meanwhile, unions warn the Senate Democrats better pass the PRO Act or else. HUD reverses a Trump-proposed ban of trans folk from homeless shelters. New York City sues major oil companies over their climate change deception. And world leaders pledge to cooperate on climate. But most see this as woefully insufficient. The J&J pause may be lifted shortly. Then the next question is, do they have an apparatus to produce any more vaccines? Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett lead the charge as the Supreme Court lifts what was essentially a ban on lifetime sentences for minors, youth, all that and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. By my minors, it occurred to me after I said minors that people might be thinking people who mine stuff in a, but I meant youth, and that's why I said that. But
interesting that Kavanaugh is in favor of people who are teenagers doing things being judged for the rest of their life.
Based that's right. On that.
Seems like that was the exact opposite argument he was making in his confirmation hearings.
He boofed one and asked the moms and came to a different conclusion.
There you go. And to be fair, much of his commentary was one thing for thee, but not for, or one thing for ye, but not for thee or me whatever.
Well, I thought most of his commentary was calendar based, but I guess these minors who are sentenced to life potentially that they didn't.
It was calendar-based and also hymn-based. But hello, Emma.
Hi.
Welcome. Happy casual Friday.
Thank you.
As folks can see, I am wearing my soft-collared shirt.
Mine's soft-collared, too.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little cold in New York still, so got to. Well, actually, maybe that's not true.
It's a little bit. It's getting
cold.
A little bit chilly.
I have
a little bit chilly.
Temperature control.
But yeah. This is the way we do it around here on casual Fridays, particularly when we get into the summer. I may even at one point wear a t-shirt, but I don't know. I don't know if that'll happen.
We'll see.
Yeah. No, we got to be careful about that. That just gets too. That things get too crazy when that happens. Folks, it is April 23rd, 2021. We are have seen, at the very least, and there we still have major hot pockets, if you will, around the country in terms of COVID infections. And we are seeing very, very you know, sort of, we're starting to see, you know, vaccine, I don't want to call it hesitation, because there's two different phenomena that are going on in terms of the vaccines. There is hesitation where people are not sure, you know, this was developed so quickly, or perhaps there is, you know, some very legitimate reasons to be distrustful of pharmaceutical companies and, frankly, you know, the U.S. government amongst some folks. And to a certain extent, that's being dealt with. And then we also have, I should say there's three cohorts. There's also folks who aren't online all the time or don't have, it's not easy for them to take a day off of work or to leave their kids or to find, frankly, a place where there are vaccinations. So they haven't gotten one yet just because it hasn't been, you know, within reach and accessible for them in some fashion. And then we have a third cohort, which are essentially MAGA folk, Republicans, a certain portion of the Republican Party. And the data bears this out. This is not even anecdotal, that feel that they're not going to get a vaccine because they may be not coming around to the idea that COVID is real or whatever it is. They're just not going to give in to the wokes.
Right.
Those wokes who support vaccination. You know, that's where we are. Hopefully, the folks in the first two cohorts will be getting vaccinated. We need to get between, they say, the scientists, 70 and 90% vaccination rate, including children, in the 100%, to reach herd immunity. Now, we don't have a vaccine that is approved for children below the age of 16 at this point. And so we need to get as many adults vaccinated as possible to get to herd immunity. And part of the problem why we have at least that third cohort, frankly, part of the problem why, you know, I think we're getting past the sort of Trump's obstacles in terms of the actual delivering of the vaccine. But part of the problem why we have that third cohort that may never get a vaccine because they don't want to give in to political correctness or cancel culture.
I mean, they were the people not wearing masks to begin with. And so if they're going to behave as they have already been doing, why would they get the Biden vaccine?
Right, right. But where did this level of ignorance, and not just ignorance, but like bathing in the ignorance and feeling like it was, you know, where did that come from? Huh? If we had a way back time machine, we could go back to a year ago today.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning, because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me. So we'll see. But the whole concept of the light, the way it kills it in 1 minute, that's pretty powerful.
My favorite part about that, when he was suggesting we inject bleach into people, was
into the lungs.
Or something like it, you know, with the light.
I'm not a medical doctor. I may be a doctor, but not a...
Could be if I wanted to.
I'm not married to the bleach.
I'm just throwing it out there, but I want everyone to see that it was my idea. Because if it does work out, then I'm the guy who gets the credit. So, I don't know. Throw it out there.
Just spitballing.
The bleach inside the lungs. I mean, it could be. I don't know. I just want to make sure that if it turns out it's something that works, I want to get...
Well, he keeps turning to Deborah Birx for validation. Remember, they zoomed in on her face?
Exactly.
As if she would provide some sort of validation for this wild, I don't know, guesswork.
Yeah, well, she's just sort of sitting there like stone-faced and really probably questioning her life choices.
Having a panic attack internally, yeah.
But there it is, folks.
Hope everyone remembers that, because that was... That was some dark times.
It was one moment where I was just sort of impressed. Like, this guy is so convinced that he's like, I want credit for it because no one else has said that. I was going to say it behind closed doors, but then I realized I'm going to want credit for the Trump bleach treatment.
And he has no concept of, I guess, the weight of his words in that situation. Or maybe he does. But it was both dark and just the immense humor of Trump. I mean, sometimes, yes, all of his actions were abhorrent. But it's hard not to remember how ridiculously, like, in a gallows way, funny the whole situation was.
Except for those few people who ended up ingesting bleach. And,
oh, geez. Right. Yes. But I'm not making light of that.
No, right. Of course not. But nevertheless, you wonder, there is a strain in the American public that is problematic. I'm going to say that.
And so much of their actions is to own the libs, regardless of cost. And owning the libs can be this amorphous thing, and I feel like that's exactly, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think that's a lot of what we're seeing with that cohort of vaccine, that tranche of vaccine hesitancy.
Indeed. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to New Republic writer Osita Wanevu, and we'll be right back after this. Folks, I've got something that's going to blow your mind. It's actually April 23rd today. Yet, there's still about 12 hours left in the SunsetLakeCBD.com 420 sale.
Whoa.
Today's the last day. You can use the coupon code 420 and you get 30% off their entire product line. So that means 30% off the tinctures, which help me to go to sleep every night, frankly. 30% off the gummies, which I know people actually also.
I have a gummy story. I just had them. I had them last night, and I had the best sleep I've had in so long. It was so, I feel refreshed. I feel happy this morning. I got a good workout in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can't, that's my problem, is that I can't have just, the gummy and the chocolate fudge are delicious, and but I can't, because if I have one, then I'm going to have like too many, and then it's going to be a mess. But they have hemp flour as well, chocolate fudge, like I said. They have a salve with arnica and CBD. They have CBD-infused coffee. Just got a bunch of Kenyan coffee. They switch depending on what they've been able to purchase at any given point. Matt is a big fan of their smalls, and I like occasionally I'll smoke a pre-roll. Use code 420 for 30% off all of it. And now they also have what they call CBD dog biscuits. I'm a little bit flexible on
what
the dog.
What you call our snacks.
I'm not bringing
Sam
them
snacks.
Into work and eating them as snacks. But yes. I mean, when I'm very well behaved, I give myself one. They've blended their CBD oil with three simple ingredients, peanut butter, pumpkin, and oat flour, to create delicious biscuits designed to comfort your four-legged friend or, you know, those folks who are a little idiosyncratic and occasionally will just can't help but be wondering what, like, a peanut butter, pumpkin, oat flour dog biscuit tastes like. The treats have 5 milligrams of CBD. There's no artificial flavorings or sweeteners. Check that out. All of this. Use the code 420 for 30% off. Do it now, folks, because tomorrow you got to go back to Left is Best and get 20% off. So check that out. And just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you get extra content in the fun half. All right. I want to welcome back to the program writer with the New Republic, Osita Wanevu. Do we have him? Oh, there he is. Osita, welcome back. Thanks for joining us. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Obviously, the big story this week was the conviction of Derek Chauvin on all three counts. Give me your broad take on what we saw this week.
Yeah, well, obviously the jury reached the correct decision, the ethically right decision, but also I think the well-justified legally decision, and that was a great moment for people. I understand all of the emotional reactions we saw and heard, both in the city and around the country. At the same time, though, I think it's obviously important to understand that this is one cop being held accountable. There's still a much larger system of inequities at work within policing in the United States. And I just think it's important for people not to assume that, you know, this means everything is right and just and the system isn't as bad as people have been saying it is. It obviously is. And I think you see after the verdict, a lot of Democrats coming out and sort of saying a lot of very strange things about what the verdict meant symbolically. And I think people are right to sort of jump on that and critique that and sort of push back on the notion that the Democrats still don't still have work to do on improving the justice system.
Well, what's your take on Nancy Pelosi's comments? I know we've covered them. We covered them on the show, but they were particularly, in my view, out of touch. And seemingly she had time to prepare for this. And yet she thanked George Floyd, for the viewers that don't remember, for sacrificing his life so that he could get justice for his murder. I mean, that to me, that signals that in her mind, she sees this conviction of Chauvin as something larger, akin to legislative action, than it actually is. In addition to just the, I think, completely tone-deaf way to describe the murder of a man.
Yeah, and you know, she wasn't alone in that. I mean, Jacob Frey, I think, made a very similar statement after the verdict, saying, in effect, well, you know, the city's better off for George Floyd having died because now we understand how unjust things are and there's been this moment of justice. Look, I mean, I think that this is indicative of a kind of broader mentality within the Democratic Party and amongst a lot of Democratic voters, where the victories that are important are the symbolic ones, right? Like, even if there are systems of inequity that everybody kind of understands and knows are unjust, you can have these moments of symbolic resonance that ought to mean as much as a real policy victory. I think you see this on issues beyond policing and criminal justice issues. I think this is just sort of a general approach to politics that, you know, has really kind of deepened over the last decade or so, or at least since the, you know, Obama administration began in 2009, since Obama's election in 2008. There's just been sort of attention to the symbolism of politics. There's always been symbolism within politics, but I think you have now a kind of way of thinking about politics in the Democratic Party where the symbols are most of what's there, you know? And that view of politics sits in real tension with obviously a rising crop of progressives, a rising left that is pushing the president now on substantive policy issues and asking for meaningful concessions and not just these kinds of fables where the death of one man can stand in place of, you know, broader reforms. And, you know, it's important to say that this isn't just, you know, this isn't just a statement that was kind of sucky and bad. I mean, you've had people, Axios reported, I think yesterday, that the verdict has convinced some Democrats on the Hill that they don't need to push as hard on criminal justice reform because people are happy now. People have seen justice done in this way. And so the pressure on them to actually turn to legislation, as Biden had kind of promised during the campaign he would do, that pressure has been lessened by the verdict. So it's more than just, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Jacob Frey, these people made a weird, bizarre statement. I think this kind of symbolic politics has real world consequences because it shapes the kinds of policies that are being proposed, if any policies at all, right? It shapes actual concrete politics.
I think that's a fascinating observation. I want to put a pin in it because I think it comes back around to actually a piece that you wrote the past couple of days about the filibuster, and so that might be a good segue. But part of the reason why I am so hesitant just in terms of doing what we do here to follow criminal cases is for this very reason. Like a criminal case, it would have been an incredible miscarriage of justice, narrowly tailored, if Derek Chauvin, when we all saw him kill George Floyd, walked away from this. But at the end of the day, the implications of that case are are, you know, because if our system is working, right? And in the confines of that courtroom, and they, when it comes to a criminal case, all the things that allowed that to happen still exist in some fashion. Do you think that the real question is on some level is like, what is it going to do? What is it going to do to the movement that was born out of, or I should say not born out of, but was sort of ratcheted up in the wake of George Floyd's killing? And what do you see that tension between what is happening with many people who still see this as a systemic problem and this, I guess, hope or excuse or whatever by the Democratic Party, who certainly rode a lot of that into office, and their sense that, okay, we're done now. Like, yeah. Like, what's that tension? Where do you anticipate that tension sort of expressing itself?
Well, I don't think the activist community is going to sort of let things go and ease up now, in part because the police are going to keep killing people. I mean, immediately after the verdict, we heard about this case of the police shooting and killing a teenage girl, you know, and that got headlines that sort of tainted whatever happiness people felt about the Chauvin verdict. So anyway, I think that the activist energy is going to sustain itself just because these, again, like, nothing has been done to systematically reform policing in this country. And we're going to continue to see abuses, and people are going to continue hearing about them. But, you know, I think that in the interim, for the reasons I just kind of described, on the Hill, at least, and within the Biden administration, it does seem like people are taking the Chauvin verdict as a reason to sort of pull back. So, you know, it's hard to say much more than the activist community is going to continue to be as serious as they've been from the get-go on these issues, and they're not going to let a temporary victory sort of dissuade them. But in terms of concrete political action happening on the national level, I think the Democrats in power are going to use this as a sign that they should sort of pull back on an issue that they're already just kind of wavering on. I mean, we remember the defund the police debate during the election. Oh, you know, progressives shouldn't have come out and made all of these systemic critiques of policing. The Democratic Party was already kind of looking for excuses to step back from this because they think it's politically, it's a political bomb for them. And they think they do badly politically on this issue. So, you know, I don't really have a crystal ball just to sort of say much more than the police are going to keep killing people. The police are going to continue to abuse people in ways that don't make it to national headlines, in ways that often aren't even necessarily violent. But, you know, all communities across this country have policing shape their lives in all kinds of deep ways that you know, don't necessarily always translate into somebody being shot, but they're still repressive and oppressive and still hurt disadvantaged and impoverished people in cities like the city I live in Baltimore. So all of that is going to continue until we start reforming the system in a more serious way. I don't know that there is a national, I don't know that there's will on the national level to do something, but certainly local activists have already won a set of victories as a consequence of the protests that happened last year. And I think that those victories will probably continue.
Let's, and we just saw, you know, I don't know, we played a couple of clips this week. You know, it's all because it doesn't happen unless it's on videotape, but of two teenagers riding home on their bikes, getting stopped by cops at gunpoint because they were black kids riding their bikes, I guess. And we had a clip, I guess this was from 2020, of a guy who was just in a rental car. Sheriff pulled him over just because he was going 5 miles under the speed limit. He was going 65 in a 70 mile an hour zone. And this type of, that type of sort of like ongoing rolling harassment obviously is not going to bring a court case, but it's going to, impact the lived experience of people. But let's talk about that notion of, I'm fascinated by that notion of when Democrats became, what led to the symbolism the symbolism as sort of results, sort of trade out. Like, I mean, I know that there's a growing frustration with progressives because Democrats are doing that. Do you think it's also possible that Democrats started to do that because people were getting antsy?
I think so. I mean, I think that there are a lot of complicated reasons why it's emerged as a sort of form of politics. I think that, again, Obama's election was a huge moment just because it really was symbolically resonant for legitimate reasons, obviously, to elect an African-American president. But I think since then, you know, the power of that moment, I think, is carried its own momentum and sort of encouraged Democrats to think about ways and to recreate that moment over and over again. But I also think substantively, and this is something that I get to in the piece you referenced on the filibuster, right? The barriers to actual policy change are so high in this country right now that if you are a Democratic, you know, policymaker, a Democratic wonk, whatever you want to call it, you almost want to turn to symbolic victories just because it's difficult to do anything else, right? Given the Senate, given the Electoral College, the kinds of victories that it seems like you can win are the ones where you say, we just appointed the first Native American or transgender or African American person to this or that. This kind of, you know, George Floyd's death, actually, in a way, if you think about it, is actually good because it showed us how justice can work in these like specific occasions. You know, that is the kind of politics you turn to, I think, partially because the actual mechanisms for doing anything more are constrained. And they're constrained not just by the institutions that I've talked about, like the Senate and National College, but they're contained by the way our economy is structured, right? We have these big, powerful actors that can shut down politics when it doesn't suit them. They can kill efforts to regulate them. They've suppressed unions, obviously. We saw what just happened in Bessemer. So we're at a moment in time where it doesn't actually seem like the basic mechanisms of democracy are truly operative, right? And it doesn't actually seem like people can use formal channels to reliably produce positive change. And so then what do you start offering to people? You start offering them people a kind of spirituality, a kind of cultural politics. And I think that partially explains why we're in the place we're in.
The I don't know if it's the irony of that, is that on some level, that's where the conservative movement has been, it seems to me, over the past 20 years. I mean, we're just joking about, you know, I'm not going to take the vaccine to own the libs. This strain of conservatism, the movement conservatism that really started to, that I guess, you know, Gingrich, maybe, you know, was the vanguard of, but we saw through the aughts where politics are downstream from culture, where all of this type of representation. I mean, I've got an op-ed here about Disney, you know, that is that Disney allowing their employees some measure of freedom and does, you know, is like ruining Disney. And he just sort of, full disclosure, I happen to be conservative Christian type of thing. But it feels almost like the Democrats have, no doubt moved into that because things have been such a roadblock, but like, it feels like that's becoming the terrain of politics in a much bigger way. Like that the Democrats are not alone in heading into that sort of, symbolism as a function of politics, cultural politics moving to the fore. And it's as if the conservatives were able to block actual real change by pulling everybody into that arena.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right that the conservatives are doing kind of the same thing, but I think that they're doing it for different reasons. I think the Democrats are moving to cultural politics and symbolism because substantive progress in achieving their policy goals has been so hard. I think Republicans are doing it because they've won the substantive policy battles over the last 40 years, right? We've constrained governments. We've cut down the welfare state down to, you know, its bare minimum size. Biden is getting all of this credit now for sort of incrementally putting things back together again a little bit. But look, like Republicans, conservatives, and moderate Democrats substantially crushed the welfare state. They deregulated a ton. Corporations are more powerful than they've ever been. Conservatives have appointed all of these justices to the judiciary, you know. So like most of the Republicans' policy agenda is kind of done. I mean, this is why Republicans under Trump in Congress didn't pass anything really, but an additional tax credit, additional tax cuts and appointing more justices. And there were things that Mitch McConnell and, you know, Republican candidates told their voters that they wanted to do. But it seems to me that the remaining parts of the Republican policy agenda are things that if they actually did them would produce a huge political backlash. Things like actually doing the kind of national restriction of abortion rights, you know, deregulating guns even more. Like everything that's left is kind of crazy stuff. You know, they can't, you know, getting rid of Medicare, you know, Social Security, like all of that is dangerous territory. It's stuff that you can sort of talk about in your meetings with the Chamber of Commerce. And it's stuff that you can sort of say in a primary campaign. If you actually did it, I think the Republican Party would be in real trouble, right? So what's safer ground for them? They're trying to cancel Dr. Seuss. They're trying to cancel Goofy at Disney World. You know, this is what politics becomes when everything you've ever wanted has actually been done, really. And everything that's sort of left is too hot to touch, right? So that to me is why they're now turning to a kind of cultural politics. I think it's just the absence of a remaining policy agenda for them.
I still remember like Bill Frist 15, 16 years ago, you know, diagnosing Terri Schiavo from the floor of the Senate, you know, saying like, as far as I can tell from the videotape, she is, you know, she's still, she's not in a vegetative state, or et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this has been, they've been ongoing. Now, maybe they never had any policies beyond, you know, cutting taxes. They certainly have achieved, I think we're at the lowest tax rates. We have been probably close to 100 years at this point, 20, maybe 80 years. And maybe they just don't have an agenda beyond that after the deregulation and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it is, and this does dovetail in with what you're saying about the filibuster. But before we get to that as well, is it your sense that Biden is like, if we had talked 2 months ago, maybe we did actually, but if we had talked 2 or 3 months ago, I think we would have been like, it feels like Biden's headed in, like it's be like Democrats are being particularly aggressive and they have a lot of momentum, it feels like, and they're busting through the doors. And now it feels like, despite the fact that Biden's polling numbers were great and et cetera, there has been a pullback. Not just because of the filibuster and because of you know, Manchin and Sinema and Kelly, but even in the Biden administration, I mean, you see it with the refugees. Like the slightest road bump has like just completely derailed their confidence, it feels like.
I think so. You know, I mean, I you know, there's writing going around saying like, oh, progressives are wrong about Biden, and this is actually like a really progressive presidency, and they should have given Biden more credit for how much he was willing to do, and so on. I mean, I went through the campaign last year thinking to myself, well, obviously, a Biden presidency is going to be an improvement on the Obama administration in certain ways. Obviously, the entire Democratic Party has been truly affected by, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign and the desire for more progressive policies that it exposed. So it's not a surprise to me that Biden would have a COVID rescue bill, you know, that was pretty good, you know, that he'd have an infrastructure bill that would invest heavily in things that are important to invest in. None of that is actually surprising to me. But, you know, I think that people who spent, you know, these last 100 days or so, it hasn't been 100 days yet, but the last couple of months saying all of that stuff should have anticipated that wasn't how the whole administration was going to go, and that there would be certain roadblocks and, you know, humps and things that the administration would not be willing to do, and that the administration was going to be more cautious than those initial policy proposals made it seem. I think the refugee situation is a perfect example of that. I mean, it does seem like it was a decision that they initially made purely for political reasons. They didn't want to be seen as overly pro-immigration. right? Given what was happening at the border, given, again, these anxieties that people had coming out of the November's election about some of these issues. But I think even beyond the refugee situation, even when you're talking about things like the infrastructure bill and the COVID relief package and how great they were, you have people like Jared Bernstein, who's on the White House Council of Economic Advisors, saying, well, look, yeah, you know, it was important to get all of that stuff out the door, but from here on out, most things are going to require pay for it, right? And they just put out this plan to boost taxes a bit. But the big investments that we really need to make as a country on issues like climate change, on truly rebuilding the welfare state, all of that is going to be very expensive. And it's not always going to be stuff that you can just sort of create pay fors for. And to see the administration kind of limiting itself in that way already is very worrying. And I think it should give people pause, even if they're willing to give the administration credit for how good some of its initial packages are. So I think that in all kinds of issues, and criminal justice, as I mentioned, is another one where you have Democrats saying, well, this is a reason for us to kind of dial things down. On all sorts of issues, I think we're beginning to see the engine slowing down for external reasons and sort of as a consequence of the anxiety that the Biden administration has about the politics of the moment, but also because Joe Biden is not a progressive. Like, Joe Biden is not somebody who came in thinking that he was going to change America. It was only the coronavirus pandemic that encouraged the campaign to then begin saying, okay, maybe we need to think bigger, right? We're now in a place, thankfully, where the pandemic seems to be kind of winding down. You know, we're making good progress. It, you know, fingers crossed, knock on wood, all of that kind of stuff. But we seem to be at a point where the pandemic is not going to be the thing that is driving policy anymore. And so the question then becomes, what is Joe Biden in and of himself actually, what does he actually want, right? It returned to the Joe Biden, I think, of the early primary last year, who was a cautious, kind of moderate, moving in the right direction in certain places, but does not fundamentally believe, as he told people during the campaign, does not think that things need to fundamentally change, right? And that's going to be a mindset that defines what the administration is doing more and more.
Yeah, he told donors that during the
campaign.
It's a way to assuage their fears.
But going to Wall Street and saying, hey, guys, don't worry. OK, it's like, you know, more or less things will be more or less the same. And, you know, and I want to get to his, you know, 40% capital gains tax for the wealthy and this and that, because I think that plays into, you know, the filibuster argument. But there's something to me that's so telling about the refugee thing, because I don't think Joe Biden has an ideological disposition to going to Wall Street and saying, don't worry, guys. Like, you know, don't worry. Let's be honest. You and I are more or less on the same page here. I might think that you need to pay a little more in taxes, whatnot. But I don't think that Joe Biden was saying 65,000 refugees and didn't believe that he would be okay with that. What scares me is that even with 60% approval rating or 63% approval rating, where if somebody had said to Joe Biden, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, you're going to be president, and 3 months in, after 100 days, you're still going to have 60-70% approval rating on some of these things, you would have been like, you got to be kidding me. No way. That's not possible. And yet, even with all of that, all it took was ABC to go down to the border and meet the press to say, you know, there's a crisis. And they just fold on something like the number of refugees. And like, who is the constituency that they're worried about losing when they're talking about a 40,000, 50,000 different person limit on refugees in this country? Like, who are the... What focus group do they have where they're like, we need to get these guys who are so tuned in to refugee status? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, you know, if I had a window into the psychology of Joe Biden, I'd share my insight with everybody, but I don't. You know, it doesn't make sense to me either. But, you know, I think one thing you can say is that the Biden administration really seems to take the concept, the value of bipartisanship and outreach to the other side very seriously, right? Everything that they've done, even when they've chosen to go the partisan route, has been prefaced with a kind of symbolic overture, at the very least, to Republicans on the Hill. So even if he's not thinking about an actual constituency out there in the public that shapes his decision making, again, Joe Biden is a cautious guy and a guy who's kind of believes that a guy who believes in sort of preemptive deference to conservative thought. I think that's the only lens through which something like the refugee initial pullback and reversal, whatever, you know, that's the only context in which it makes sense. I mean, it's also notable that it took people posting and there was sort of this outcry for them to sort of say, oh, okay, we'll fix it. Like, this is not an administration with a real direction, like a sense of where it's going. You know, that's the thing. Like, the only thing that's actually provided that, going back to the campaign, has been the pandemic, right? That's the only kind of North Star the administration has had. And once that goes away, I think it's going to be obvious to people that they're just kind of, you know, playing everything by ear, and aren't actually willing to go in the, you know, fully in the direction progressives are hoping the administration goes.
Well, to me, the constituency that you can find is the Beltway media, though, because you mentioned that ABC stunt where they went down to do their talk show with the border as the backdrop. Where the Beltway media takes an issue seriously, I think the Biden administration will. They did not take Republicans' concerns about the $1.9 trillion stimulus package and that cost seriously. I mean, there was barely a whimper from the GOP on that. And thus, the administration went. And so I think that could be a good barometer going forward, because there is no North Star beyond, as you say, COVID. Is that a thought that you might, think is valuable?
Whether the media is guiding things? Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the media, I think, on most issues has been incredibly friendly to the Biden administration. But you did see that a couple of weeks where they're pushing, you know, there's a crisis at the border, Biden's got to do something. You saw columns come out again saying, well, if we don't restrict immigration, then the far right is going to, and the Biden administration needs to start kicking people out and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think that they are a factor, obviously. But yeah, I mean, it does not inspire a whole lot of confidence that they would be able, that they would reverse a pledge like that. And then also, even though it was the right decision, that it would just sort of take like an hour or two on Twitter to sort of put them back. Like, this is an administration that is not have a kind of as a backbone. It doesn't really have anything that's sort of holding it together or pulling it to a particular place.
I mean, I throughout the campaign was saying that Joe Biden is my second favorite type of politician, because he's a cipher. And I think that how quickly he backed off the it hasn't been sufficient in terms of going back up to 65,000.
Right.
But I think that you're absolutely right. There is no, yeah, I don't want to say it's quite rudderless yet, but there is no, they're just like, there's no wind blowing. And so their flags are just sort of furling and looking to catch some type of wind to push them in some direction. Do you think that, I mean, I think that's different from what, like, Joe Manchin, who specifically doesn't want to deal with certain things. And so, so I want to just, like, sort of touch on that element of your piece about the filibuster, because, Joe Manchin came out for the PRO Act, and, just yesterday, some of the big unions basically said, look, we're not going to provide funding for Democrats, or at least those candidates who don't vote for it. Like, I can't help but think, like, we're looking at a series of kabukis.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Manchin, you know, sort of saying, like, I'm for the PRO Act, but I know it's never going to get there because I'm not going to vote for the filibuster. The union saying, we're not going to fund you unless you sign on to co-sponsor this. And Kelly and Sinema and Warner may end up signing to co-sponsor it, but they'll bring it to the floor. But if there's no filibuster reform again,
yeah,
and so the unions won't actually have to carry through on their threat. I mean, there is just a sort of feeling of, like, as long as we all articulate that we want this, that's enough to win in the next election, as opposed to actually doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all a big kind of charade, you know. I've adopted, you know, this view of a lot of American politics where it is just sort of like, it's kind of theater from top to bottom. And you can think about it in terms of, you know, in the 2020 election, I went out to vote for Joe Biden in Baltimore, Maryland, fully cognizant that it didn't matter, right? Like, this is a symbolic move. Maryland's vote doesn't count, etc. And that's true of most people who participate in American democracy, right? There are only a couple of states where that vote is actually capable of making a real difference. So on that level, it's kind of a sham, right? When it comes to actually passing legislation, as I point to in, you know, the piece you're talking about, we have a situation where any majority short of 60 votes cannot really do anything unless it's willing to get rid of the filibuster. There are things you can do through reconciliation, but that's not most kinds of bills. There are strict rules about what can and can't happen. If you're not willing to overrule the parliamentarian, those rules are going to stand, you know? And so we end up in these situations, Congress after Congress after Congress, really on both sides of the aisle, as I point out in my piece, where all of the promises that are made don't actually come to pass. And the answer from party leaders is, well, next time around, we're going to win even more seats. And all it's going to take is, you know, we're going to go and unseat Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. And you need to donate all this money because that's what it's going to take to actually pass this or that. And it's all nonsense. Like, it's all of it is nonsense unless there's an actual strategy for winning 60 votes, which nobody actually has because it's impossible now, given the way that partisan polarization is borne out. So it's all nonsense unless you are actively willing to get rid of the filibuster. That is the central issue of federal policymaking in this country, whether or not the filibuster stands. And if it, as long as it does, the promises that candidates make to voters can't really be relied upon in any kind of way if they're not talking about fiscal policy that can pass the reconciliation. It's several layers of theater stacked on top of each other. That is what Howard described American democracy at this point. There's no real consistent relationship between the outcome of an election and how much policy gets passed. And there are politicians, even when they're in the majority, who prefer things that way. Joe Manchin doesn't want to take a whole lot of difficult votes, you know, on the progressive agenda. You know, I don't think he wants to vote on the PRO Act, actually. But it's good enough for him and good enough for a lot of his voters to say, well, you know, I support the PRO Act. I'm a co-sponsor. I think this is a really good idea. Unions are very important and blah, blah, blah. While at the same time meeting with the National Restaurant Association, as he did earlier this week, and telling them, well, I think, you know, your power as companies is very important, and it's important we don't burden you with things like the minimum wage and so on. Like, he can talk out of both sides of his mouth on this issue because of the filibuster. And that's just how Congress works now.
You know, it's interesting because when there was talk of getting rid of the filibuster back in the aughts, the idea was, you could drop it down to 55 as opposed to 60. And all that's going to happen is you're going to change the cohort of people who are going to rush to be the fulcrum there, right?
Yeah.
It's going to give them more power. Because it's at 50, it's, and maybe because of Manchin is who he is and Sinema, who is like, I feel like Joe Lieberman would have loved to be that 50th vote. But Joe Manchin, I think, is terrified of being that 50th vote.
Yeah.
And I think that is what is happening. And maybe, you know, maybe this.
Just to interject, like, Lieberman would have loved to be the 50th firewall vote. Joe Manchin wants to use that to leverage his posture as being the guy in the middle ground, which,
well,
I think is very different.
No, I think the opposite. I think like Lieberman wanted to be there because he wanted to be the guy to make or break. But I think Manchin is not the guy who wants to make or break. He wants to maintain his brand. But
that is the brand.
Yeah, no, but Manchin doesn't want to be in the position of actually having to take that vote.
Yeah.
And Lieberman would have, because he would have wielded it like a sword.
Right.
But Manchin is afraid. He's the guy in the, you know, who's playing left field and going like, please don't hit it to me. I just want to be out here. I like wearing the uniform and I like, you know, coming out and hanging out, but I don't want to, like, because you pop it up to me, I'm going to drop the ball. He's afraid of taking these votes, I think, is what it is. And so it is functioning. The filibuster is now functioning as a way to protect him and obscure, of course, what the parties believe in. I mean, that's a relatively recent phenomena, I think, where and the only thing I could say, and maybe I fall prey to this problem of symbolism, is that that could be a good sign that at least a guy like Joe Manchin's on his heels, as opposed to Joe Lieberman, who would have been like really excited to screw over the Democratic Party. I think Manchin's just afraid to take any of those votes, and he's just better off if it's like out of my hands.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. So, you know, it's not a good place to, ideally you want people, you want an institution where bills that move from the House are actually coming up for votes and you actually have a Democratic outcome. But so much of it depends, again, on the kind of psychology of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema that is inscrutable to me. You know, I think it's a matter of guessing what their motivations are. But, you know, hopefully at a certain point, there's a critical mass on at least one of these bills that forces a moment of truth. Again, we're in a kind of rudderless place where Democrats are just kind of, okay, we'll do all this reconciliation and punt on every other part of the agenda, right? And sort of wait to see what Republicans are going to do. You know, I think that, so one example of this was the Asian American hate crimes bill. I think it was last week that came into the Senate, and you know, political report. Well, this is going to be a big first test for Republicans on filibuster, and Democrats are hoping that Republicans filibuster, and that'll produce you know, the kind of outrage about the filibuster that's going to motivate change. Well, Republicans just sort of said, okay, well, we'll amend this and pass it, right? So it's just this kind of deferential, you know, reactive posture that's governing what's happening in Congress right now. And at certain points, they're going to run out of reconciliation bills. And one bill is going to be the moment of truth where we actually decide whether or not we're going to keep this thing. And, you know, I hope that moment comes relatively soon. But I don't know what bill that's going to be. And I don't think Biden knows. I don't think any of the Democrats in Congress know. They're just kind of feeling things out.
Where is the pressure point here? Because I feel like, you know, you could send, you know, there could be, you could send 10,000 people to protest in front of Joe Manchin's office and send them from, I don't know, whatever the organization is now that would motivate those people. And Joe Manchin would be like, I love it. I mean, he'd be... Yeah. Out of his window with his, you know, like, here's the picture of all the you know, the fringe,
yeah,
protesting me, proof that I'm my own guy. And yeah. But so who is susceptible to that pressure? Is it Biden, and then Biden goes down and says to Manchin, like, you need to do this for me, or that type of thing? Or where's the Maybe not the weak underbelly, but where's the chink in the armor, as it were?
I mean, I think it has to be Biden, honestly speaking. Like, I think, again, we saw with the refugee situation that there is a kind of sensitivity to public outrage, you know, that ought to be leveraged as much as possible. But yeah, I mean, I do think it probably is going to come down to people insisting that Biden take a real stance on the filibuster. He's come out and said the talking filibuster would be good, but that in itself doesn't actually solve the problem. I think the way it's going to have to work is, you know, people tell Biden, or it becomes obvious to Biden, that there needs to be an actual conversation with Manchin, Sinema, and the rest of them on this specific issue. And he needs to kind of tweak them and push them. And I think you're right about, you know, Manchin using pressure from the left as sort of fuel for his next reelection campaign. That's not the way to do it. So, you know, Biden ran on the idea that he was uniquely capable of negotiating between different parties, that he understood how the Senate worked, that he was able to work with segregationists. You know, I think if all of that was true, and I think that, you know, all of it was kind of oversold, but like, if all of that was true, well, now is the time to actually use those skills to move your agenda, right? I saw yesterday that the Democrats are hoping to bring in Joe Lieberman, actually, on statehood. They think that him coming back to the Senate and talking to people about it is the thing that's going to move that issue. The person they should be bringing in is the president of the United States, right? The president should be going in and telling people that they have to pass statehood and get rid of the filibuster. That's his role. Joe Lieberman is not going to do it. So, you know, I think that's ultimately we have to kind of hope for. I think public pressure, some senators I think are going to be more susceptible to pressure from the left than Manchin is. I think in Arizona, you know, it's a different kind of state than West Virginia is. So I think Sinema is more vulnerable in that kind of way. But, you know, ultimately, I think the channel is going to be the public expressing itself to Biden, the president, who then has to go to Congress and make things work. If anything's going to happen, that's the way it's going to happen.
All I can think of is, like, what are they going to give Lieberman? I can't even begin to express it, but...
I thought Osita was joking at first. That's
No, absolutely.
It's reported.
It happened.
I meant to bring it up, but I couldn't actually get the words out of my mouth. Osita Wanevu, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We're going to link to your pieces at the New Republic. Great stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to I'm going to do something to just get the idea of Joe Lieberman out of my head.
Right.
And
stick a thumbtack in your hand.
That's exactly what it is.
Something. Right.
We'll be right something back else. As I light a match under my hand. We'll be right back. Joe Biden announced the introduction of the second tranche, as it were, of the infrastructure bill. It's unclear how they're going to present this structurally as legislation. If they're going to put both pieces together in reconciliation, my guess is no, which
is not smart.
Well, it is smart if they're not terribly interested in the second part. That way they get the credit of putting it out there and it just doesn't go anywhere. And so we will be on top of that and more in the coming days, in the coming weeks. But for those of you who are leaving us now, we will say adieu and see you on Monday.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Indeed. And for those of you who are sticking around, you are the lucky ones because we have Andy Kindler is going to be joining us momentarily, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, we have him.
Right now?
Yes. And we have Andy Kindler's music?
We will in just a little bit.
All right. Oh, boy, this is exciting. Whoa. Let's get the music first. Wow, he's dressed up. Hold on. Here comes the music. This is it's a lot of anticipation.
I'm not even going to say anything.
Yeah, he's done some work on the background, as you can see. It's off-white today.
Do you like Andy Kindler? You know you can't go wrong. His ancestors wrote the God Bless America song. A true Obama bot, and he believes Obama can never be wrong. Yeah, AndyKindler.com. You made me laugh so hard, I had to write you your own theme song. Andy Kindler.
That of course, was the intro song to Andy Kindler by Jimmy Reefer Cake. I think he's still at All the Hypocrisy.
It's the greatest song ever written, and people thought that I would bothers me. Any song that mentions me and Jew in it, to me, I want a copy of that.
Let's be honest, Andy. Any song that mentions you, period, you're done. Like, right? I mean, come
yes.
on.
Yes. Yeah. You even Hitler had written a very funny parody song about me, and I didn't like him. I don't agree with Hitler. Regardless of your feelings about Hitler,
the song
was a very funny parody song.
Emma's here with us.
Hi, Emma.
Hi, Andy.
Andy, how have you been?
Oh man, I think I've been well. I mean, I have nothing to complain. Haven't left the house. I won't be leaving the house. One vaccine in, one Moderna in.
Oh, and when do you due for the second?
Monday.
Oh, that's
26. But they think I'm 90 years old and from Peru.
What?
I'm 64, Sam. 64.
Why did it take you so long to get it?
Why did it take me so long to get anything going with my career and then it ended so fast? Oh, I'm sorry. That was a different story. That's a different feeling.
What happened? Were you just like you weren't going to leave the house or did you get...
I haven't left the house. I have friends even today. I don't know how I got it. I was on a cruise ship playing bowling with a group of people. I have made no mistakes. I've been nowhere. I haven't been in a restaurant. I don't shop for my own food because of my white privilege. I have people come bring my food. I don't talk to them. I don't look at them. I talk to them about classism for a couple of minutes, and then boom, I'm on to my
don't tip them either.
Through the door. Through
what's
the-
that?
You don't tip them either, right?
No. No, actually, I do tip because I'm scared of being accused of being cheap because of the Judaism.
Gotcha. Right. Well, I just thought that, you know, your discussions of class were, you know, enough for them, enough to sustain them. That was
well, No, really. People tend to like me if they see me quick.
Yeah. No, I think a little bit of Andy goes a long way. Yeah. Wait, now, Andy, let me ask you this. First off, I want to just compliment you because you look like you're really put together. It feels like you have a new shirt.
It's not a new shirt. It's like one of the, it's a Jimmy O shirt. Jimmy O, I bought this at Jimmy O. It's for short, it's for men 5'8 and under.
I don't know what Jimmy O is. Where is
I'm
that?
Not getting any money for it. It's a short man's shop. Do you want me to say it a third time? It's a short men's shop.
Why did you just get like boys' clothes? Why do you need?
Unbelievable! You claim to be a liberal, but all of a sudden, when it comes to short people, have you heard the venom coming from the Majority Report about short people? That's what Ben Shapiro might have said if he had.
Andy, how long after you get the first vaccine are you planning to go out and do one of these shows? I mean, I'm seeing like some of
doing it right now. What do you think?
No. I mean, go like, what is your plan? No plans ever.
No plans. Virtual Kindler from now on.
You're done.
I'm 64 years old. What am I hocking myself for? What am I going to fly over to Omaha? And because I've been vaccinated twice, does that make sense to you?
I know there's shows going on in L.A., outdoor shows.
I will be at Union Hall when it's safe for me to be there and everyone has been tested. And also, I have perfected my on-stage bubble.
But okay. Once you get that second shot, it's...
Oh, I am looking forward to it. I am looking forward to it. I don't want to be in a plane, though, or anything crazy.
COVID and be sick from it. Let's put it that way.
I know. I'm looking forward to. I am very, very much looking forward to this. Don't you think I have an up tempo feel to me?
Ew, what's going on?
I cut myself shaving here today.
So you shaved and you got on this new old shirt of yours that I feel like I just never seen you wear plum.
Why are you shaving all the way up here by your eye?
That's the question. It's not how did I stop it? How did I put a styptic pencil right there. That's not the question. The question is, how do you get up there? How do you get up there to begin with?
I know. I'm asking you.
No
emotional problems. I'm still nervous about getting on the Majority Report. This is my last gig. If this goes south, I'm gonna be bleeding from here as I get ready to go on the Five.
Are you going on the Five?
Oh, I do go on the Five because I'm good friends with Juan.
Juan Williams?
Yeah. Isn't he liberal over there?
You know, I'm glad you brought up the five because we have some footage from Gutfeld.
Unbelievable. This guy has been so... I have hated him longer than anybody, I think, in the biz.
People seem to think that he's like a former comedian, but he never did stand up.
Will you wait to play this? I have to run to the...
Oh, yeah. We can just talk. We're just going to queue up Gutfeld. We're not going to play it until Emma gets back. But people...
I'll talk slow.
People seem to think that he was a former stand-up, but he never did stand-up, right?
He never did stand-up. I have people who say that he, at one point, with the Maxim days, he had a sense of... I do not believe that he ever was funny. He's incapable of being funny. He might be the worst... He is worse than Hitler. Now, I don't know if that's me. I'm guilty of hyperbole. I'm not calling him a Nazi. I'm saying he's worse than a Nazi.
He is. Because
they were funnier. Goebbels, at least, had an appreciation for modern art.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. You're saying not so much on the fascistic. He's not necessarily more fascistic than Hitler. Just as a rounded out person doesn't have the same sort of like policy attributes that would have like put him... As a person, better.
Well, I don't know. This is Wolf Cuomo. I don't want to start early, but I'm Wolf Cuomo reporting. You get it?
Yes. No. You combine.
You understand what I did, Sam?
I saw what you did. We'll put a pin.
Hold on that. But this. Well, there has never been anything funny said by anybody from the point of view of. The right way.
No,
it's impossible.
Crew that used to do Red Eye with him. Do you know any?
No. I love Andy Levy, who is a very funny guy, and he used to be the halftime guy on that show. But that's I loved Andy Levy, and there's a couple of people who've gone on that show, Joe DeVito, who are funny comics. But I hate the show. And in fact, Tom Shalhoub, I have unfollowed Tom Shalhoub, who is a very funny comedian, very nice guy.
Was he really funny? I mean, Shalhoub. I mean, like, look, Shalhoub.
He was okay. I mean, he was competent.
He was very competent.
Yeah, but he wasn't like a bad guy on stage.
No.
He was just like a nice guy. I can't accept that he could be nice and then be doing this stupid.
Shalhoub is interesting. We're actually going to watch a clip of him because I've known Shalhoub since the early 90s. I mean, when I first came down to New York, I probably met Shalhoub because I think we were probably starting our careers at similar points, maybe. Shalhoub always struck me as a guy like Jim Gaffigan without the edge.
Right, but of course, Gaffigan is very politically aware.
Wow, he is. But I'm saying, like Shalhoub at the time was like Gaffigan without the edge.
I know what you're saying. He never was. I never thought he wasn't laugh. He wasn't fall down funny.
Right.
Right.
He was competent.
Competent and seemed pleasant. But you can't seem pleasant. I'm sorry, Tom Shalhoub. I'm sorry for having unfollowed you. It was a rough. I feel bad about it. I can't follow these people anymore. I can't follow anybody. I need to them to prove. They have to prove they don't like Hitler.
Tell me about Andy Levy. What was his deal? Because
he's a very funny guy. He did the halftime report on Red Eye. Yes.
And so was he, because it doesn't appear that he's associated with this show.
Oh, no, he's not associated with Fox or,
okay.
or anybody yet.
Gutfeld was advertising for comedy writers.
Oh, I know.
It seems to me, if you've got to advertise for a comedy writer, you are not, you're in trouble.
Well, don't misunderstand me. I have a packet in there. And the thing is, look, Sam, we can joke here, but when Papa needs to feed the small chickens, I'll take the money. I don't care whether it's from Glenn Beck. Or Goebbels, or Eichmann's children, I take the money.
Let me ask you, I'm not as concerned about the Goebbels children or Eichmann, but the chickens.
You know, it's been many years since I've been on my game. They don't say it's early dementia. They say it's natural.
Okay.
No, I'm off my game, you know. But thank God you still you still have me on. Why is this character? I'm so sick of doing this self-deprecating character. I'm so incredibly popular. It doesn't work. It's like Jon Stewart talking about, hey, I'm doing my little cable show. I used to hate when he did that. I'm sorry. He used to bug me with that. Hey, I'm doing my little cable show. You know, I know that's nitpicking. That's nitpicking, Sam, what I'm doing there.
You're nitpicky. That was nitpicky of Jon Stewart.
Yes, a great person.
So now, wait a second. Are you telling me, because I want to get to this Gutfeld stuff, but are you telling me that you're going to throw off the self-deprecating Andy Kindler character and introduce a new, more confident, like a super confident Andy Kindler character? Like,
here's the 8x10. Here's the 8x10. I can't help it. I'm funny.
I don't know about that one.
No, I don't know about that one. I think I really hate myself deep down. That's why I'm in therapy. And it seems to work for me.
Right. So you can stay with the self-deprecating.
Because I know some things about politics, and then there are things like vast areas where there's a plane and there's, what are they? Tumbleweeds blowing through my brain.
Oh.
Planes? Planes?
Yes, planes. So,
planes.
Like a
whenever things don't go good, but who am I? I'm a Jew from Queens. Boom.
I feel like you're just, all you're doing now is just practicing different headshots.
The worst thing that was ever invented was the ability for me to see myself while I'm performing. It is absolutely, I'm a son of a narcissist. I'm the grandchild, everything as my great, this is a true story from my grandmother. Someone was complaining to my grandmother. She goes, Blanche, I have the thing. I got an operation next week. And my grandmother went, as long as you have your health. Nobody in my family has ever listened to anyone. We're narcissistic people.
I have to say, watching you on Zoom, the way you act on Zoom is very reminiscent of my 8-year-old son.
I appreciate you getting me up. Usually I'm compared to a toddler. So I really appreciate the upgrade. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. I got that from my father. If you looked at my father for more than 5 seconds, he would start going like this. He did not want to be looked at. He's very funny, but he did not want to maintain a stare. So he would.
Yeah, but if I start doing that, my kid's going to be looking at me constantly. It's the only thing that's going to keep his attention.
Well, it's supposed to unsettle you, right? Right, Andy?
What's that?
It's supposed to unsettle you for staring
at him. No, I think he thought it was entertaining. I thought he thought he was so... My dad was like very, very funny. Very funny. But he didn't like to go too deep sometimes, so... If he thought he was being stared at, he would entertain you with his face. And most of the time it worked. It wasn't good at funerals. It wasn't good if I wanted to talk to him about something.
Right. All right. Well, let's...
I didn't mean to make you sad, Emma and Sam. This is not sad. Don't think it's sad because I'm using the extender cable or something, and I'm hovered over my router. Don't feel it's sad at all.
No, I, you know, it might be, I think I'm going to buy you some posters. I think things come off as sadder because I don't know why, like, how long have you lived here? Probably like what, like?
Are you in an office space?
My wife doesn't know I'm in here.
Like, where are you?
The music stand.
I'm in my office.
But Andy, how long have you been living in that place? Actually, I got to say, it makes the mood better.
Well, why do you got have a music stand? You playing the flute?
Because I do voiceovers or something like that.
Oh, have you been doing Bob's?
I've been doing. Yeah, this I bought it. I got Comedy Central bought this for me once in lieu of.
Wait.
I'm doing. Are you kidding me? Did you get your $500,000 check?
Wait a second. Have you been recording Bob's? I'm doing the movie eventually, but
I have done a couple of ADRs. I don't want to get too technical with the ADRs and the
Are you? Have you been doing more episodes?
Not a lot, Sam. What's up? Why do you look like you're going to punch me?
Well, I just want to know, like, who's got the inside track to the Bob Jimmy Pastels was shut down. And
what happened? I can't Google. I Googled Jay Johnston. Nothing. It doesn't come up. It's the sad. It's one of the saddest things that's ever happened. Well, not really. How well did I know Jay Johnston is the question.
Obviously.
I thought he was hilarious.
Obviously, not that much.
He was a sweet person.
Hey, let me put this out there, Andy. And I'm not saying that you're obligated to assess this idea and then push it to the to Lauren and the others. But what do you think of this? Hey, Bob, I've shut down Jimmy Pastos and I've decided to retire as health inspector and open Hugo's. So I will slide right in as your nemesis across the street.
That's so good,
isn't it? Because Hugo would take everything he learned about the restaurant business,
yes,
and apply it to Jimmy Pasto's.
Yeah.
And you
didn't see Hugo on January 6th. You didn't see Hugo up by the Capitol.
All right. Listen, I think you should pitch it.
Okay. I will.
All right. That looks great, incidentally. And next week, next time, big screen TV. All right, let's do this. We've got Gutfeld. We've got to analyze this.
Gutfeld Follies.
Yeah, let's. This is the first clip we have of Gutfeld. This is the writer's room is hitting their stride. This was from what episode? This is from Thursday. Was this from last Thursday?
No, I think this is Wednesday, actually. I mislabeled it.
Okay,
Wednesday. April 21st.
April 21st. So the show, Gutfeld, has been on now for a couple of weeks, and you can see they are really starting to gel and click here. This is their famous all-Trump news network bit.
Oh. Hold on to your sides. Hold on to your sides, because you're going to start to laugh.
The callback, too. They've been doing this a bunch of times.
Oh, yeah.
News, but 4 years ago, they devoted 1,900 minutes to Trump, mostly to trash him, and they never let up. Even today, they can't stop talking about him.
You're watching ATN, all Trump news, because everything else is boring by comparison.
I'm Anderson Lemon with the headline. Product placements could soon be edited into classic films. Scientists have developed the technology to insert ads or products in scenes, which could generate extra revenue for streaming services. It's all well and good until Donald Trump tries to put his name on Nakatomi Plaza, which would turn Die Hard, a fine piece of American cinema, into nothing but trash. Just like everything else Trump touches, it turns to trash. Except for trash. He touches trash and it turns into more trash. Made sense, right? Turning to news overseas, after six British football teams pulled out, the European Super League has been suspended. The exodus started with Chelsea and Man City, and other teams quickly followed. Must be nice to live on a continent where the biggest concern is a soccer game, while somewhere in Florida, President Trump is plotting a run in 2024. I mean, where are the world's priorities right now? Man City? Is that even a place? Is that something Trump came up with? Man City? More like mansplaining. Manchester City. And a new study finds that people who drink 3 to 5 cups of coffee a day have a better memory. The research does not explain why anyone would want a better memory after 4 years of Donald Trump. I mean, who the hell wants to remember that? Every memory I have since 2016 has Trump in it. How about I give you a study on drinking 3 to 5 cups of tequila every day? You know what happens then? You forget everything about Donald Trump, and it is beautiful, my friend. Ooh. Ah, yeah, that's good stuff. Woo. I'm Anderson Lemon, all Trump in this.
Look at him. Look how...
how happy he is.
Yeah. So
his writers laughed at the bit that they wrote. And so,
yes, I heard some of the inside, like with Tom Snyder's of cameraman laughing.
Andy and Sam, I wanted to ask you, as like you've been in a comedy, I don't want to call it courage.
That's not comedy.
But like when you see a performer, like you've probably known people who have had to just commit to things that are just horrible. I can't help but feel sorry for that woman when I see her try to get
through.
But
it's shameful. There's no, unless I have a picture of her family starving and that they would have starved had she not taken this gig. It's a shameful thing to be associated with.
She's an actress.
Who has no political...
But my point is this, is that like, just from an artistic standpoint, put aside the you know, how people...
Oh, she did a great job.
No. My point is that she's an actress, not a comedian. Like a comedian would have a problem delivering those lines because they'd be
like, huh? Like, is she actually an actress?
This is speculation on my part, but yeah. And Andy, back me up on this. A comedian, the reason why comedians have trouble with acting is that they actually assess whether the lines are funny or not.
Yes.
And they can't do it if they don't think it's funny. But an actor will do it and doesn't. There is no bad roles for an actor, right? They just.
I guess so. But the thing is, there's literally. I swear to God, Sam, when I was watching this, I was very groggy this morning. I thought they were slamming Trump for a second. You know what I mean? And like, because I was like, yeah, okay, I agree with everything that they're saying. What's the angle on this? This show's turning on Trump. So I couldn't believe, but there's literally, you can't be funny from the right. You can't be funny from a power position. There's nothing funny about being in a power position. There's nothing funny about, and there's never been anybody funny from the right, ever.
But this is worse than that.
That's worse than that, yeah.
It's worse than that, because first off, she ends the thing by saying, like, implying, I've been drinking tequila, and that's the way that I forget about Trump. Except for the fact that all I've been doing is reminding, saying how I can't forget about Trump. Now, yeah, I know that's, I'm analyzing it a little bit.
Yeah, you're analyzing it as if it's a comedy bit.
But the other thing is that there's no twists in this. They tell you the title of the news network.
Yes.
And then everything is exactly as you would imagine, and it's not even clever on how you get in there. Honestly, the most clever thing was, this is a study about coffee, yes, how it remember things, but who would want to? And that was the most clever twist in the whole thing.
You can't even focus on that. I mean, I still can't get, I'm just walking around the apartment all day saying, I'm Wolf Cuomo. Huh? Wolf Cuomo, anything?
How did you come up with that?
It's unbelievable. If you take the names of the other people and you put them together, you never know what's going to come out.
It's fascinating to me. And they're just like, we're going to make this work. Like, it's like, this is the thing I think about, like, with conservative humor. Like, they really, they're really like determined, like, we're not letting go of this. Like, after the first this bit, they probably said, oh, wait a second. Maybe we shouldn't have made it so like one note and ham fisted. And they're like, but we're not cutting it now because we're not going to admit defeat. No.
Don't they slam Jeff Zucker? Don't they slam Jeff Zucker in that piece? Or
I don't know.
They call when they slam Jeff Zucker by name as if they found the heart of the left. And they've stabbed it. You know what I mean?
It is the amazing thing about what they're doing is it's the same problem they had when they had their like sort of specific half hour, hour.
Half hour comedy hour?
Yeah, comedy hour. When they were trying to sort of like, compete with The Daily Show. It is that they conflate comedy with like snaps, it's honestly look at how we're owning the libs. It doesn't matter that we're not doing it in a funny way. We're doing it. It is like literally, it's like doing an industrial. Did you ever do those? We did those, like Benjamin and I and David Waterman and Rich Gustis. You don't know Gustis?
I don't know Gustis. I know Waterman.
When we were in Boston doing the comedy lab, we took a gig where we went to work. We did a Wang They were a computer, I think they're still, or a Wang computer like retreat. And they, what they do is they sit there and they say, like, here, make some jokes about the R&D people and, you know, about how they don't get the work requisitions. And so we tried to integrate that in. I mean, we left them completely befuddled. They thought we were just out of our we were completely insane. But that's what got the big laughs, when you just go, like, at least I'm not like Marge, always putting my requisition forms in pencil, and the whole place erupts. And that's sort of what they do for the conservative movement. It's just like,
it's just recognition of
exactly
something. It's just that I recognize this, and so that's got to be a laugh.
Exactly.
Right.
The Lemon Anderson, that's true. Like, those guys do that all the time. And
yeah,
that,
it's literally conceptual peekaboo.
Exactly. All right, but we're not done.
But remember in the old days, they used to say, like, I remember some show, they go, yeah, they do jokes like, I'm a card-carrying member of the ACLU. What is that card for? I mean, like, stuff that literally nobody is really going to be upset. You know, like, someone's got to stick it to that ACLU. You know, there, when are they going to get stuck to?
What's also, like, what are they, they're, I guess they're skewering CNN. And who cares?
Like, yeah, I know.
People like, well, you're really taking on CNN. Like, it's, I don't know. I guess the idea was that, but I don't understand why they didn't just call it CNN.
Well, it's not close. I mean, and it's ATN, which is like
All Trump News. Why is that different than OAN? I don't understand. I don't think there's a joke, even an attempt at a joke.
But why wouldn't you have just done it as CNN and just done a parody of CNN?
Yeah.
Like, instead of like this sort of like, we're going to be clever and call it the ATN. Why not just call it CNN? And the joke is, all they keep doing is bringing it back to Trump.
Well, then you wouldn't have told the punchline before the skit even starts.
Excuse me, Mr. Gutfeld. I'm a little bit confused. It says CNN, but they talk about Trump all the time. Shouldn't it be Trump All the Time Network or all Trump?
Well, here you go, CTN. Can't we? If you made an amalgamation of CNN. Get out of here, underpaid person.
We're going to call it All Trump Network so that people get the fact that they talk about Trump all the time. And then we're going to surprise them when every story is about Trump.
It's rather, I don't feel bad at all for anybody involved there. But when you see it so rudderless and so completely out to sea, makes no sense what the person's doing. Everyone's in a different department over there, I think.
All right. Here's the one. We talked about Tom Shalhoub. And I used to run into Tom when he was trying to get the Red Eye host job following. And before then, actually. And I would say, you know, Tom, you should come on the show, on my show. And we can sort of debate stuff. I don't want to do that. I was always telling Michael and old Matt, I was like, I ran into this guy and I'm trying to get him on. And, you know, I'm like, you know, it could be interesting to have him on.
Oh, so he was open about his political views back then.
Well, he was, I knew he was on Red Eye.
Oh, right.
And so.
Well, before that, I don't know if he ever, I mean, he may have been one of these guys who never ever said anything.
Yeah, and he would downplay it too. He would downplay it a little bit. All right, so here is Greg Gutfeld. This is Gutfeld. Now, this is from Thursday night. And now, you know, they have the other bit that they go to quite a bit, which is the CNN, where all they do is they say, you're racist, you're racist, you're racist.
It really gets it. It really gets it. Yeah, but we do when we call racist people racist and we call Nazis Nazis.
But they don't even need to capture it because no one watching this even watches CNN.
Like, no, you're right. Nobody watching that. I think people watching, I don't think people are watching that, are they?
No, but they presume. I mean, I get that idea, but what is amazing to me is that they were smart enough not to call CNN the I'm racist network, because then they had that surprise element of what are they going to say on CNN? But they're running that bit again, but they did come in with a twist.
by a white kid with a coexist bumper sticker, which is why CNN's entire premise is that all of us are hopelessly racist. And if you disagree, then you're racist, creating another us versus them. Wouldn't it be refreshing if once in a while CNN would point out what we have in common instead?
You, ma'am, are making some great points right now.
No. You, sir, have a very persuasive argument.
Of course we should hold police accountable.
While respecting them for serving their community.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, me too.
Why are we yelling?
I don't know. Jeff Zucker told me to yell.
Zucker. But you know who's really at fault in all this oppressiveness? Angry white men.
Oh, hey. Just out for a run. Exercise, it's a real stress reliever. These days you need it. The politicians telling people to take to the streets. You know, sometimes I think they're trying to divide us based on race or what group we're in. I don't care what you look like. I care what you do with your life. I don't know. Hey, Phil.
What an evil man. If it were up to him, the streets would be soaked in oil.
Why was he out for a run?
I don't even get, I swear to God, I've watched that 7 or 8 times now. I don't understand that bit. I get that at the end, I get that they're not angry. Of course they're not angry. You see those guys, they're so obviously not angry.
He seems to resent people protesting a little bit. I mean, it might not be angry, but it's a bit of a resentful white man there.
Oh, he just... Oh, right, that's true. Well, he seemed like an idiot in that particular thing.
The weird part is that they went from the CNN thing into, here is our presentation of the angry white male, and they don't attribute it to anybody. Like, that graphic, that's not a graphic. It's not like... Like, if the bit was... We're going to do a profile on the angry white male. And then they just go, then that might be funny because then you're attributing it to CNN. But they just come up with a graphic that they clearly made. It's not supposed to be attributed to CNN. It's almost like, you know, that those comics who would go up and wear like a funny shirt and they go like, hey guys, I know you're looking up here. What's with the shirt? Dude, you put it on before you came on to the stage. Like, why?
I don't get it.
Like, what? Like,
why am I wearing this shirt all of a sudden?
So, like, it doesn't make sense because the whole gag is we're going to come up with a straw man of angry young man, angry white male, but it's the guy's clearly not. So. When we came up with this graphic, we were wrong. Like, it's not attributing the perception of Tom Shalhoub as an angry white male to anybody but them. Because where did that graphic? It's not right. CNN. CNN hosts had cut to...
Yeah.
We've done a report. You know, I'm Wolf Lemon. And we have done a deep dive into the angry white male psychology. Here, let's go look at this interview. And he goes, oh, I've just come back from a run and I just do things that are, you know, we should just not divide each other.
Hey, well, how about those two actors? Actors in that one? Were those actors? No, those are right-wing those people.
Writers. Right? No, those are writers. No,
those are right-wing writers.
The two people at the beginning were comedy writers.
So
they wrote that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't. Are people always screaming on CNN?
The way they're screaming, I've been annoyed by CNN. There's so many things that are annoying by CNN. What? Look, I'm not going to write any material for them. I refuse.
Well, it's because they take themselves too seriously, not because they scream over each other. That's just not a part of the thing. That's not a thing.
Well, they had that crossfire philosophy forever over there.
Like 2003.
That's true.
No, but even like recently, remember they had that guy who was, they had a series of guys who were Jeffrey. One guy was named Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Lord.
Yeah, Jeffrey Lord. They had these, it's like, well, we have to reflect the other side, you know, both sides. We're a both sides company.
Right.
And they would just bring the series. And those people, they actually made those people more Ken Cuccinelli. They helped Ken Cuccinelli move into the government.
But in the skit, they're agreeing with each other and yet still screaming.
Oh, I didn't get the skit. I don't think the skit. The skit fell. I don't think the skit holds up.
I thought that skit was. I thought that part was actually one of the best things I've seen from them.
Yeah.
The idea.
Really?
We're yelling and we agree with each other. I mean, that I feel like. I felt like that was almost like was recognizably an attempt at comedy.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And the fact that it was a sketch.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the two of them had a little enthusiasm.
Yeah. No,
it felt better during that part.
Yeah. And then they just did that whole, like, and now we have almost like a complete non sequitur that you can't really tell is associated with CNN, but it's as if there was a weird Vice-like channel that has sort of like modern graphics and mislabeled something.
Yeah. Well, has someone from the right ever made anything good? Didn't that guy make the movie that was supposed to be American Carol and he made it American? This is a few years ago with what's his name? Brother was in it. Farley's brother was in it. The Zucker brother who's gone bad.
And they
tried to do, what if all the right people from the right hadn't been born? I didn't see the movie, but it was called American Carol.
I think those guys, I mean, I'm not necessarily a fan of, but Trey Parker and the other dude.
Yeah.
They're
right wing libertarians.
Yeah. So, I mean,
libertarians.
It's sort of funny, but
I never liked those guys either. But, you know, the reason I didn't like those guys for one simple reason. They got very successful. Their show got picked up when mine didn't get picked up.
That's fair.
And I never liked their show that much. So I had so many reasons to keep a grudge.
I'm not going to lie. I've never seen.
Never seen South Park.
I've never seen more than
a couple minutes.
Not even, maybe, whatever, 2 minutes of South Park. I'm not an animation person. I don't like animation. And I watch.
You're on Bob's Burgers.
I love doing it. It's very fun. And the only Bob's Burgers I've ever seen, I don't think I even watched the whole thing, was the episode where I was singing and Nude Beach. I think it was that episode.
Don't put this on your voiceover reel, this anecdote.
Okay? Right.
The voiceover's dead. Nobody's doing
it. Okay, but don't put that in your room. They don't want to hear it. They go, you know, I don't even care. It's, God bless them. I'm the other way. I'm like, I'm ready for everything, for any kind of right-wing
Andy Kindler
propaganda films.
We are so glad that you were ready for this, because it's all...
Oh, you did a local news wrap-up. But that should make us all think, Emma. I love you guys.
Andy, always, you, always Andy. A pleasure. Oh, folks, check out Thought Spiral.
Thank you for saying that. It's two Jews, two microphones, 2 hours. Just voted just number one on the podcast charts right now. The number one podcast in the country.
And you guys are still in test phase, too. So that's really impressive.
Told them test shows.
That's right. It's still
big. Thank you. Thank you for the plugs. And I love you guys so much. And this, and I'm going to work on this area.
So it looks so much better now.
I'm really
with that.
Enjoying that. Yeah.
Yep. Is that,
that's you.
That's me as on a part. I played the agent on I'm Dying Up Here.
Yeah.
Showtime.
And that Andy, was always a pleasure.
I love it.
Thank you, Andy. We'll see you later.
What am I selling? Amway now? What's the matter with you guys? I hate this part where you say we're going to leave and then I have to press leave and then I'm still there.
And you are selling Amway and we've got to be on our way. Uh, Yeah, Andy seems like he's got a lot going on, says Demian. Look at Emma. You really like that. We've got to be on our way.
It was the cutting off of him in the middle.
All right. Should we? Freebie Friday. What the hell? What
Hey-o.
The? We're letting it ride, folks. We're putting it all on.
Wait a minute. Pause. Hit the pause button. Something's wrong.
It's the only thing that you have on your soundboard. Oh, God.
I got this too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. All right, let's go right into this clip by Ron Johnson, who is... Does Ron Johnson have some type of polling information that suggests there is a huge cohort of Wisconsin voters who are looking for the dumbest man alive to be our senator? Is that what's going on here?
It's probably fundraising information, I would guess.
Ah. Here is Ron Johnson talking about how, you know, the... if it's not the 5G they're injecting with you, it is the record of injecting you with 5G.
Well, what happens when there is no way to sustain COVID as a control mechanism? Climate emergency is what we're going to face next as an argument to keep us locked down. Travel restrictions, of course, they'll try to keep the patina of COVID on that. But climate emergency is the next step to locking Americans down and controlling them in
I just want everybody to think about this.
The Vicky McKenna show.
So there is a they that has interest in locking us down, right?
Says Vicky McKenna.
The question is, who is the they, and to what benefit is it to them that we are just traveling a little, less?
Well, it's the global elites. Sam.
But what is it that they are getting from this?
Well, because if you are traveling less, or if you have a vaccine passport where we can control where you travel...
But wait, they haven't gotten there yet.
Okay, oh, sorry.
Just a basic premise. She says they are using COVID as a way of, you know, controlling us, and now they're going to use something else to control. But what is the benefit? Like, why are they... This is just like a... Is this like a bet that two of the global elite made in like the men's room, and they're like, you know, like it's like trading places type of situation? Or why are they doing this? And if it's just those billionaires who, you know, for wealth inequality, why isn't the next thing you say like we need to have a wealth tax here and expropriate every dollar they made over the past year?
They
want
to keep us all docile so that we don't see what's really going on, which is that they're, you know, obviously eating children and drinking their blood.
That's the weird part. It's just like there's no, it's just a blow by that like, wait, why are they doing this? Good.
Pituity.
Well, that and vaccine passport. Listen, I was a big supporter of Operation Warp Speed. I thought that was brilliant, the way we squeeze every inefficiency out of developing vaccine. But, you know, from my standpoint, because it's not a fully approved vaccine, I think we probably should have limited the distribution to it to the vulnerable. To people that really aren't, you know, to the very young, I see no reason to be pushing vaccines on people, and I certainly am going to vigorously resist any kind of government use or imposing of vaccine passports, but they'd probably get the private sector to do it for government. And that could be a very freedom-robbing step. And people need to understand these things. So, again, you're talking about climate change is the next step. I don't think they're going to let go of COVID anytime soon. I mean, what is the point? If the science tells us that vaccines are 95% effective. So if you have a vaccine, quite honestly, what do you care if your neighbor has one or not? I mean, what is it to you? You've got a vaccine, and it's, you know, science is telling you it's very, very effective. So why is this big push to make sure everybody gets a vaccine, and it, to the point where you better impose it? You're going to shame people. You're going to force them to carry a card to prove that they've been vaccinated so they can participate in society. I'm getting highly suspicious of what's happening here.
I wonder if he has the same suspicions about children who, and we should say, there is no vaccination that is approved for any children under the age of 16. But the fact is that if you want to send your kid to school, kindergarten, public school, you need to provide for the school a card that says your kids have been vaccinated against a couple of very highly transmittable diseases so that the other kids don't get it. Because it's 95% safe. And in fact, there was a story of in a nursing home recently. Where was that nursing home, Brendan? Do you remember
Kentucky.
That? Kentucky, where the vast majority of people, all the nursing home, the people living in the nursing home, residents, had been vaccinated. But some of the caretakers were not, some of the people working there. And one came in, had a variant. A lot of the people got COVID. Most of them, the nursing home residents, were fine. They didn't even show symptoms. One died who had been vaccinated. Now, these are older people. They're going to be more susceptible. They were probably in very close contact an extended period of time. This guy who had it was probably a super spreader type. They can't quite figure out why some people spread it really efficiently and others don't. But the idea that like they're out there saying, why do people need to get vaccinated? Because you need to achieve a certain amount of herd immunity if you want to wipe out the virus in the context of the United States.
And prevent it from metastasizing and creating new variants. I mean, it's not that hard. Brendan's saying that apparently Ron Johnson still hasn't gotten the vaccine, so his defensiveness is personal here, obviously. But, I mean, part of what conservatives wanted at the start of the pandemic was herd immunity. Now we have the ability to achieve it via vaccination in some fashion.
I don't think there's ever been a situation where there has been herd immunity achieved in a pandemic. Well, certainly not in a pandemic, but broadly speaking, without vaccination.
So there you go, dude. I mean, which one do you want? Does he want thing?
Does he feel that there shouldn't be, that you shouldn't allow restaurants and stores to have like a no shoes, no shirt type of situation? I mean, if businesses find it more lucrative for them to cater to the majority of their customers who feel safer if they're in a closed space with vaccinated people, then is that really the sort of Republican line that you're going to inhibit them? I mean, because I think businesses should be inhibited in many ways, frankly. But that seems to be an odd take by Ron Johnson, that you're not going to allow businesses to sort of require. I'd be far more inclined to go into a restaurant if it was, you got to show that you're vaccinated to get into the restaurant as opposed to sitting outside. It's pretty stunning that this is where they're at. I mean, but of course that's, Ron Johnson. It's just nuts.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, do you want to talk about Sean Hannity upset about LeBron? Because you were
sure. Hold on one second. Yeah, sorry,
also got that Trader Sam story that we must not forget to get to.
Let's read that now.
Sam's very excited about folks, this op-ed that he read.
Folks know I like to get every perspective on some of the important burning issues of the day.
Every opinion is valid. And, as news people, we have to take into consideration all perspectives.
That's right. And I spend a lot of time reading the Orlando Sentinel, just so that I'm up on Central Florida News. There's a lot of stuff going down in Kissimmee that I want to be aware of. Kissimmee, Florida. And so I am constantly reading the Sentinel. And I came across this op-ed. I love Disney World, but wokeness is ruining the experience. And what I thought was interesting about this was the just how all-encompassing wokeness is, actually.
All-encompassing?
Yeah. I mean, you
also,
know,
this is a... How old is this person who wrote this op-ed?
Well, this guy is in his, I believe, it's 40s or 50s.
Oh.
My family and I have been loyal Disney customers for decades. For decades.
So, he's really into Disney at this age.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Disney's actually, like, you know, if you got kids who are little,
if they're little for
decades. Well, you would think that they would have the emotional attachment to Disney, and wokeness would be ruining it for his kids. But I mean, like, I mean,
you get used to going to a place. I mean, it's magical. It's like that's what the magical Magic Kingdom.
I went there at 12, and I was a little bit too old for Disney.
I will concede that I went there in college and took acid in Epcot Center.
Wow.
That is awesome.
Add this to the canon.
That was pretty fun. And then I went there back there with my daughter, and that was fun. It was fun to see it through my kids' eyes. And I would take Saul soon, actually. And then I would never go back.
Right.
So, so consequently, we spend way too much money in Orlando. Ooh, that's the hook, right? We take a Disney cruise every year or two, right? We vacation at Disney World every year. Consequently, we spend too much money in Orlando. He set the stakes. It's not just his emotional attachment to Disney. It's like, hey, Orlando, do you still want our money? Unfortunately, I am strongly rethinking our commitment to Disney, and thus, Orlando.
Oh, man.
Yeah, man. The more Disney moves away from the values and vision of Walt Disney, horrible homophobe, I think he was, Walt Disney.
Among a lot of things.
Walt Disney, yeah, he was an anti-Semite, right?
Well, I mean, look, let's see. His vision was pretty good. The less Disney World means to me. Disney is forgetting that guest immersion is at the core of its business model.
He wants an immersive experience free of wokeness.
When I stand in Galaxy's Edge or Fantasyland, I know I'm in a theme park. But through immersion and my willingness to set the real world aside, something magical happens. That spell, of course, is broken when the immersive experience is shattered by the real world.
AKA, he's having a bad acid trip, probably.
Mm-hmm. And boy, has Disney been breaking the immersion. Now, we're talking about an adult, incidentally.
All right, I have the op-ed up. This is a picture of the guy. Wait, no. I'm not going to turn that to the camera. We can show it.
Right. Show.
I'll take a screenshot.
Recently, Disney announced that cast members are now permitted to display tattoos, wear inclusive uniforms, not sure I understand what that means, and display inclusive haircuts. We'll show the guy in a second. Disney did all of this in the name of allowing cast members to express themselves. Do you know what inclusive uniforms and inclusive haircuts means?
I mean, I'm not sure. I think...
Maybe it lets, like, black people have braids.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it might, you know, if you wear a hijab or something, you can still wear it and play a character.
Right, that's probably.
Yeah.
Okay. The problem is, I'm not traveling across the country and paying thousands of dollars to watch someone I do not know express themselves.
Okay, so he's not.
I am there for immersion and fantasy, not the reality of a stranger's self-expression. I do not begrudge these people their individuality, and I wish them all well in their personal lives. But I do not get to express my individuality at my place of business.
That sounds like a you problem.
Well, I mean, I wonder what his job is. Does he have to wear a uniform at his job? Maybe he does.
Well, we talk about you're governed not mainly by the government, but by your boss.
Yes.
This is a good example of this.
But by the way, he's really into Disney again. Are those Disney figurines behind him?
Well,
can
wait
we
a
pull
second.
That up?
We'll pop up the picture of the guy right here. He's John super into Disney.
Van Bostrick.
And there he is. There's his Disney.
Look at that shirt.
Apparently, he's really into self-expression there, but he's going to save that. He's not going to do that at work. More broadly, like many corporations, Disney has been politicizing its business. Now, the idea is that we're not going to force our haircuts on our employees. We're not going to force them to laser or cover their tattoos, or we're not going to force them not to wear religious garb. And he's saying this is being politicized. Full disclosure. You ready for this, folks? Mm-hmm. This, I hope you're sitting down. I am a Christian and a conservative Republican. So the people who run Disney and I do not see eye to eye. Regardless, corporations have always made politically motivated decisions. Usually it's due to the desire to make a profit, but sometimes it's due to the values of the people in the corporation.
Ooh. At the expense of profit?
Disgusting. Walt Disney used his corporation to express his patriotism during World War II and his pro-capitalism beliefs afterward. The difference today is that the people who run Disney use social media to scream to the whole world that a decision has been made for political reasons.
Wait, how is that different?
Social media didn't exist then.
Walt Disney used his corporation to express his patriotism during World War II and his pro-capitalism beliefs afterwards. The difference today is the people who run Disney use social media to scream to... Okay, so he's upset. He'd rather they, you know, just send out a press release or something.
Right.
He's a big Marshall McLuhan fan. And he thinks the medium is the message.
Yeah.
I like it the way it used to be, where I would read about it in a newspaper, not on social media.
Seems like a semantic argument.
And then let's get to the meat of this. We're going to get to the complaints. Disney is in the process of taking the woke scalpel.
That's the name of my band.
That's actually not bad. To the Jungle Cruise. Trader Sam is out because he might offend certain people.
Is that you?
Mm.
He offends Sam. So let's put up a picture of Trader Sam and get a sense of like, oh, is that Trader Sam? She doesn't.
This is the video.
Oh.
Here he is on the Jungle Cruise.
Do we have audio for this?
Oh, there's Trader Sam. He is.
Unmute it, maybe, bro.
Some type of.
They give you the. If you go back to 11:30, they'll give you a little spiel on Trader Sam here and kind of his background.
It's very. Today is drawing to a close, but it would not be a trip to the jungle without. This is Trader Sam. Sam is, of course, the head salesman here in the jungle, but his sales have been shrinking recently to really cutthroat business. So he's having a pretty terrific 2-for-1 special going on today. Going to two of his heads, or just one of yours. Maybe next time. It's a great deal. You know, any way you slice it, you really do come out ahead.
Just great stuff.
And all those puns are going to, be wasted. Totally wasted.
Do we have a picture of?
Like a static picture of street?
High quality.
Yeah.
Just people get the.
Yeah. It might offend certain people. Every grown-up in the room realized that Trader Sam is not a representation of reality and is meant as a funny and silly caricature of what?
Yeah, I want to talk about this, and Brendan, if you can put up the high quality, because the shrunken head thing, Trader Sam as, like, so shrunken heads were originally a religious practice in basically Peru and Ecuador among these tribes, and then enter in Western traders, and all of a sudden the killing for these heads starts rising because the demand goes up. So it's actually pretty dark that you'd have a guy in a top hat named Trader Sam that is basically selling heads. The irony is it kind of does depict reality, a pretty dark reality that we shouldn't have been okay with. And that's why Disney is getting rid of it. The caricature. Yeah. Just saying it's a caricature doesn't really tell you that much.
And it's a caricature of what? Like, I mean, it's just like, what is it supposed to be caricaturing? And
really creepy face.
Now, if you're in total immersion, isn't the whole point is that you don't contemplate that it's a character? Caricature?
And
like, isn't that the point of total immersion? Like, I'm not thinking about contextualizing this. I'm believing all of it. Isn't that the whole point?
Yeah.
Isn't that the point of his argument? That, like, I don't want to be taken out of the moment. So I don't perceive it as a caricature. I see it as a real thing. That's the whole point. It's total immersion.
He looks very realistic.
Yeah. Every grown-up in the room, which is also funny because a lot of people go to Disney World, apparently children.
News to me. But if the grown-ups get it, the kids not getting it might be the problem here.
It was so awkward when I approached the princesses and was like, "Hey guys, I've always wanted to meet a princess and this and that." Yeah, like it's like they get a little bit weirded out when
weren't totally immersed in the experience.
Well, every grown up in the room realized that they were not
that runs contrary to the total immersion if you're realizing.
This guy actually think that Disney is primarily for the grown ups in the room?
Well, it's based on his photo, I think maybe.
It is no more based in racism than every Disney caricature of an out-of-touch white American dad.
I can't think of one off the top of my head.
What, Disney World? Well, I mean, imagine there is like there's some of that in TV shows.
Like Wall-E or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
But Wall-E was like 2011.
The next time I ride Jungle Cruise, I will not thinking about I will not be thinking about the gloriously entertaining puns of the skippers. We just heard that. I will be thinking about Disney's political agenda. That's a mood killer.
I'll be thinking about
gloriously
how Stalin
entertaining.
I'll be thinking about how Stalin had people erased from photographs. Like that's what this is.
Disney proclaims that Splash Mountain must change because of its association with Song of the South. Song of the South is a pretty like racist trope-filled movie. Disney owns Splash Mountain, so it could do what it wants. But if Disney screams at the top of its corporate voice, which is pretty loud, that it's changing it to appease a certain political point of view. Now, every time I look at the ride, I'm thinking about politics.
The poor sentence construction. But if Disney screams at the top of its corporate voice, which is pretty loud, that's my favorite part thus far. Yeah. And also,
I mean, it's good.
No, it's just like he's going to take one of those photos going down Splash Mountain. And instead of, screaming in ecstasy, it's going to be like this, because he can't stop thinking about the politics of Splash Mountain.
Yeah, if they get rid of like all the racist tropes on Splash Mountain, I'm not going to enjoy it in the same way. And it's the same with Pirates of the Caribbean, he says. Disney has made significant changes to Pirates of the Caribbean over the year. Whether Disney caved to political pressure or really thought the alterations were necessary is irrelevant.
It really shows how ideology works that he thinks things like the Song of the South aren't political and they're only just now being politicized.
Well, that's the thing. They're natural. They're natural. Representation of people's black lives is...
It's as natural as the mountain in Splash Mountain.
But is it really irrelevant if Disney caved to political pressure or really thought the alterations were necessary? Like, what is that? Like,
no, that's undercuts the entire premise he's trying to write.
Pirates used to be one of my favorite attractions. My family would always ride it first on our first day at the Magic Kingdom. Now we don't even ride it every trip.
Going, dude.
Maybe they're getting bored.
He's not even living in Orlando. He goes all the time.
Yeah, this is like it's like a drug not hitting the same guy. Like you need to search for meaning elsewhere than fucking Disneyland.
When my family rides Pirates now, each of the changed scenes takes us out of the illusion because they remind us of reality and the politics that forced the changes.
Seems like a you problem.
I mean, it also seems like a made-up problem, frankly. Disney, like he's not even sure if they did it just because they felt the alterations were necessary.
I know, I mean...
What if something broke? Like, it has to be exactly like it was 50 years ago, or...
I know. I mean, it sounds like he needs, like, therapy. He has some sort of, like, you know, arrested development situation.
I mentioned to you that I went to Epcot Center when I was in college, and spring break, and a buddy of mine, we took, you know, some hallucinogens on Epcot Center, and I went back there with my kids 20 years later, and the whole International Village was bigger, and I'm like, I don't even feel like I'm in the future anymore, because this wasn't here before, and now I gotta think about this is here and it wasn't there before. And I was like, wait a second, they have more countries, and I'm like, this doesn't feel like the same world anymore, because there's different countries here.
Well, the fact that they're now representing Korea, yeah. It's like, that's politics infecting your situation.
And then I was like, I don't remember that lady working at that store. I'm completely taken out of the whole experience because she wasn't there the last time I was there. Disney is going to lose us as customers if it continues down this path. Definitely. I do not want to have Disney World taken away from us because Disney cares more about politics than happy guests. And then, of course, he goes on to say this should matter to the people of Orlando because I'm not going to spend my money in Orlando anymore. Unless, of course, Orlando comes out with like some type of like a racist theme park, and then this guy's going to go all the time and build some new traditions.
No, he can't. Obviously, his values don't align. No, but the end is funny. Disney, please return to the values and vision of Walt. They're on a first name basis.
Mm-hmm.
The customer experience should be the core of your business model. Immersion should not be sacrificed on the altar of political correctness and appeasing the Twitter mob.
Mm.
Jonathan Van Bostrick lives in North Las Vegas, Nevada. So he's like,
do we have his profession?
I mean,
I think he might work for the district attorney.
Yeah, that's what I heard too.
Thanks. Oh, wow. There you go.
What I don't understand is like this argument that, you know, it's going to cost customers. Like Disney hasn't already thought of this and realizes that the culture is moving in this direction. Like, where do they go from there? Because that's been their argument, you know, forever.
Well, the problem is that the reason why Disney is doing this is because they don't want to lose customers.
Yeah.
And it's just the wrong, it's just the different customers. And that guy is, he's not going to go, he's going to find a new, more race, you know, racist Disney world. I'm going to find a new place where I can totally immerse myself. And not have to think that there's anybody else except for people exactly like me in the world.
Yeah. I mean, he wants an immersive experience in a fantasy land, which is why he lives in Las Vegas. I'm joking. Las Vegas is fun.
What should we play? Oh, well, here's Dave Rubin with a similar complaint. Dave Rubin is going to explain that there, if there's anything that we should be worried about in society when it comes to racism, it's that they're coming for the white people.
Man, well, first off, I want to congratulate AOC because we played a video of her yesterday where she had complete word salad and nothing she said made anything close to any sort of sensible sentence. So I'll give you credit where it's due, lady. But... meaning that she did string together a couple words that kind of made sense there, but it was all drivel, everything that she said there. First off, we do not have systemic and institutional racism. There are no laws in the United States that are racist against any one person. By the way, I do believe that the woke left, that the progressives will instigate laws that will be racist against people. They will start having anti-white laws. This is not a crazy conspiracy theory. They're for quotas already. We know that they don't want a certain amount of Asian people because they're overrepresented at Harvard. Well, these are the places where do all these bad ideas that leak out into society, they start at the university level. So if you're going to say we in the government, we are going to have diversity and inclusion departments where we are going to hire based on the color of skin, then you are going to discriminate against a certain set of people, which in most cases will be white people, right? It will mostly be white people. It will be Asian people as well, obviously. So there is no systemic and institutional racism.
He doesn't understand what the word systemic means.
Mm-hmm. He conflates it with institutional. He doesn't know the difference between the two.
He doesn't know the difference too, and he also seems to conflate that with governmental. But we have examples over the past several years, even with this right-wing Supreme Court, of the right-wing Supreme Court striking down racist voting laws in that were passed by governments in states, Texas, North Carolina. We have examples of this in the past 5 years, 6 years. Aside from, you know, never mind institutional. Yeah, I mean, have you? We played a couple of clips this week of black people being harassed by cops. White people do not get pulled over because they're going 65 miles per hour in a 70 mile per hour speed zone.
But it's the flip side of his racist logic there, right? Which is that, oh, of course, white people and Asian people will be hurt based on college diversity initiatives because they are inherently the most worthy of going to those institutions. Black people are going to be harassed by cops and maybe killed by them, or definitely killed by them in a disproportionate rate, because they are the ones worthy of that harassment by cops. I mean, that's the conclusion that they don't say out loud. And I love how he says it's not a conspiracy theory that the woke left is going to implement, you know, white systemic racism, right? But somehow it's a conspiracy that there is systemic racism for black and brown people in this country. But it's not a conspiracy in his mind that
we're going to have racist white laws are going to come soon. Because,
white governmental, institutional, right. Systemic, all of that racism, right?
This is Dave Rubin basically just, you know, desperately trying to find his audience again. You know, doing this to appease Glenn Beck and his new boss.
And I love how it never will happen. Like, that's the tragedy and the symphony of Dave Rubin. is that he's constantly trying to get the brass ring, but he's just not talented or smart enough.
Yeah. Well, he'll have a, you know, sort of a brass plated ring. That I think he's achieved. Wait, what's this? Did Greenwald went on Glenn Beck to do what?
Say we don't care enough about the Electoral College.
Let's put this. I'm curious about this.
He starts talking, you know, more traditional Greenwald talking points about due process in terms of the Matt Gaetz investigation, that Democrats are against due process, but it gets there.
And then remembers he's on Glenn Beck.
They don't believe in due process. They find people guilty all the time. Look at what they're doing to Matt Gaetz now. I'm not saying mm-hmm. Matt Gaetz is, you know, not guilty. He may be guilty of everything that he's being accused of and mm-hmm. more. But thus far, yeah. There's been no evidence presented of any kind, and they have him convicted and locked up as a correct. Pedophile. The whole Me Too movement.
Second. By convicted and locked up, what does that mean in this context? Did Matt Gaetz go to prison? Is he locked up? Or is there basically like a media frenzy around Matt Gaetz that is about as typical as just about anything that in our society? Like, right? I mean, we see this all the time.
No, I mean, I appreciate Glenn's commitment to defending the powerful.
But I mean, this here. This critique is a critique of like it's a wholesale critique of society. But I mean, Matt Gaetz is not the only example of this, right? I mean, we've seen this example from across the board. We see this, you know, I don't know, we see this type of stuff all the time.
Like things aren't proved in court and you talk about them before, particularly because the person involved is odious.
Right. And it would be a problem if there was no trial and Matt Gaetz was sent to jail.
So DSA is detaining Gaetz now. They have him
Yeah, they frog marched him out of the House of Representatives.
Then he's got a point. But to say that, like, it's just full of hyperbole, and they're saying all sorts of things that are not appropriate, and they've got him locked up and convicted. Well, no, he's not locked up and convicted.
Well, he is in the court of public opinion, Sam, and so it's all about cancel culture. Don't you see that's all that matters?
I didn't realize right. that. Okay, so it's metaphorically locked up and convicted, but there's no real evidence. Okay, so continue.
There's been no evidence presented of any kind, and they have him convicted and locked up as a correct. Pedophile. The whole Me Too movement was about destroying people based on accusations that are unproven. They don't believe in free speech. They don't believe in due process. They don't believe in just the standard democratic processes, including the safeguards that our founders put in, including making sure that states that are small and rural have equal representation in the Senate but not the House, so that they don't get they want to change all of that. They want to change all of the rules to ensure that they remain in power forever. It is a genuinely repressive and tyrannical party and a movement that supports it. And it's the reason I've become so violently alienated from it.
So now the issue is that people want to make the Senate, I guess the Electoral College, more democratic is the problem. I mean, the Senate is I think the Supreme Court arguably too, but the most undemocratic institution that we have. And what's stunning about this too is that, like, the idea, I got news for you folks, there's rural places in New York. In fact, much of it is rural in terms of land mass. And I would say that there is relatively, let's say, like, I don't know, how many people in North Dakota, Matt? 600,000, 800,000?
About 700, 750.
There's probably 800,000 people in New York state who live in rural areas. Probably maybe more. So the idea that, like, you know, somehow you're depriving, you know, that there's some fundamentally different sort of like experience of the rural people in one state versus another is just absurd. It's just absurd. And this is the idea that you would want the Senate or the Electoral College or whatever it is to be less undemocratic is authoritarian.
One person, one vote. You know, you're basically Stalin.
Is the most Orwellian thing that one could imagine.
I'm what a bummer.
Such a bummer. But at least we know that Glenn Beck, he at least is in the.
Yeah, you know what, too? Sorry. I mean, like, Glenn's whole thing about, you know, the Iraq War and the lies that led us into that. Why doesn't he talk to Glenn about his role in that? I mean, they're both Glenn. Why doesn't he talk to Glenn Beck about that?
Because he's got the right enemy, which is the tyrannical Democratic Party, and they got their eye on tyranny now. That's the thing to emphasize every day on the Twitter feed.
It's not just the Democratic Party. It is all, it goes way beyond that, because it's not just the Democratic Party that has convicted and imprisoned Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz is imprisoned and convicted by the entire society, which is dominated by the liberal narrative.
You're right.
So it's not just the Democratic Party. It is all of the liberal society, all of the non-Glenn Beckian, Tucker Carlson society.
The non-socialists.
The non-socialists, exactly. Wow. All right. Well, let's take some IMs, then we got to get out of here. It's Friday.
Hell yeah.
That is, that's pretty bad. Let's see. The most popular Fox News shows, and Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz are obviously recognizing that in order to win, they must become a multiracial working class party. Hawley, who voted against the, oh my gosh, okay.
Tweet for the audience.
Married to Mothra. Pogrom going on in Israel at the moment. I haven't seen anything like specifically right now. Kirsten Cinema. Did you know chocolate chip cookies were not invented till 1930? Can you imagine a world without chocolate chip cookies?
What a fun fact.
Trance Warfare. Sam said he might wear a t-shirt when it gets out warmer. Are we going to get suns out, guns out? Well, we'd have to tie it to something. Hot Pockets. Brand ambassador. Sam, glad to have you aboard our embedded marketing campaign. Jewish Space Laser. Burks did indeed provide some sort of validation for Trump's ramblings. Doctor from New Jersey. Sam, very few people are aware of this, but in the George Floyd's family civil case that they won, one of the medical expert witnesses for the plaintiff attorneys was a guest on TMBS back in December. I was on with him. Who was that, Matt?
Sorry, say that again?
One of the medical expert witnesses for the plaintiff attorneys in the Floyd civil case was on TMBS in December on with Dr. Eric from New Jersey.
Oh, I'd have to look that up.
Chauvin or acquitted, it would have been a scary precedent set where anyone who were killed by police could have their medical history put on trial, successfully yield reasonable doubt. Interesting.
Yeah.
Sam from Ottawa. It's my birthday tomorrow. Hoping my premier's resignation as the world best president. How about a shofar until then? Drop in the bucket. Urgent question. Would you ever consider dating a Republican who isn't very political?
No.
I mean, for an extended period of time, I find it hard to believe that I could get along with that person.
What's the point in dating someone for a short period of time? All right. Well, I'm a woman, so.
Well, it's not that you're a woman. Like you're a different different stage of your life. I mean, I've
you've been married
for kids. And involved in a long term relationship.
You still have to spend time with that Republican, like. Pillow talk and all that.
I mean, it sort of depends on the person. I mean, it's not. Would I consider it? I would consider it. In fact, I'd consider going on dates with a Trump Republican. I like to argue.
You do.
Yeah,
that's true.
Nerd Cheetah. I mean, it wouldn't last very long, but that's okay. Nerd Cheetah. Sam, I want more details on the network of consequences you described when telling Brianna Joy Gray that it's unreasonable to expect the squad to behave like one. I'm sorry. That was like 3 months. Matt, it's disempowering to want that. Should I just accept that Biden won and voters must lean into the Republican light version of Democrat? Look, the bottom line is the force the vote. Now, I understand that somehow I failed force the vote by not coming up with alternative versions and huddling with Jimmy Dore about what they should be prior to it. But the fact of the matter is the force the vote was just the dumbest thing in the world. And I was perfectly fine with putting pressure on the squad. But the expectations of what people can imagine they can do, and I think it's good to continue the pressure. But some of the expectations are just simply foolish. I don't remember the network of consequences. I don't remember that, to be honest with you.
I mean, as per regarding Biden, I mean, I'd covered this on Left Lurking last night. If the only view you have to this issue is that months old, publicity stunt that failed miserably, I think I don't really care to address your concerns more than that. So I would point you to last night's show.
So here's a tweet from Bree yesterday, apparently. Why is the PRO Act, whose passage is contingent upon unlikely filibuster reform, considered a more grown-up, real-world, achievable goal? She's mad about what Chomsky said. Achievable goal than withholding COVID bill votes for the $15 minimum wage or force the vote. Well, force the vote was just a stupid thing. That was, we're going to specifically aim for a vote. Withholding COVID bill votes for $15 minimum wage, I don't think that's not necessarily a bad idea, except for the problem was they had the excuse, at least the leveraging of the parliamentarian. I think they could have overcome that, the administration, but from as a political matter, it would have been harder. And again, Here's the difference. Joe Manchin doesn't give a shit if the minimum wage is raised to $11 an hour. He does not give a shit. If he doesn't, you know, he may pay a political price if he's seen as stopping the minimum wage from reaching $11 an hour. But in the end, if he can wash his hand of it, he doesn't care. There is a different stakes for different cohorts of lawmakers. And if you don't care that there is any raise in the minimum wage, that gives you a lot more flexibility. All you need to do is make sure that you're not held responsible for it not going up a certain amount, as opposed to affirmatively making something.
Yeah.
It's just like, this is...
It's not worth our time.
I'm just saying that in general. I mean, that's just basically a general point that I think people don't fully appreciate.
Also, Mick calls for the PRO Act, I would say, would be a good use of time.
Yeah.
Wow. The DSA has got... Now, I know this is a bad thing that they're doing, is they're organizing and actually, like, calling. And
sellouts.
They're organizing.
Fucking sellouts.
And, you know, Osita had a good point. It's like, like Kelly and Sinema, they, you know, it's not a slam dunk for them to be seen as opposing unions. And enough calls to them, you know, may change their votes. And then, as Osita said, at one point, there's going to be something that is going to force people to be explicit about the filibuster. And the fact is that if Joe Manchin is facing the 50 co-sponsors and Schumer brings up that bill, and there is the narrative becomes that the vote against the PRO Act is actually the vote against filibuster reform, then you have an outside chance of getting it.
Well, and even from the perspective of somebody who would want to prove the Democratic Party is ultimately impossible for reform, pushing it in this way where it does say, hey, Schumer, all right, all the stuff you're talking about, what about the filibuster, right? Then you'll have an actual example. So it's a win-win. Either we get the PRO Act or you get another thing to hang on the Democrats. I don't understand distracting from that at this point.
Right. I agree. Beth Van Dwine says one thing for thee. One in a district where she outperformed Trump. That's the lady from the fake clock controversy. And now she's all but sure to get reelected because of the redistricting in Irving. K-Cancer. In the Midwest, it's somewhat common to be pulled over for driving under the speed limit, even as a middle-aged, non-affluent white person. It's a weird quirk of policing, but it's not as racially motivated as other dynamics. Interesting. Lopushku. How should we pressure AOC and other progressives? Is there a way to expert a greater influence? It feels like they're neutralized and quiet. Well, the pressure should be on people who are the obstacles to this. I mean, I think it's good to tweet at AOC and say, this is what we want. And it's good. But the bottom line is the pressure should be deployed on the clear obstacles. And that is, and to the people who have the greatest amount of leverage, which is Joe Biden. Right? I mean, it's like AOC is not going to get Joe Manchin to vote to reform the filibuster.
Yeah, and the Green Party burnout contingent of force of vote isn't really concerned about pressuring the Democrats. Their entire thing is that's absolutely impossible to do.
I agree.
And I'm not even talking about them. But it's like, what is it that you think you're going to get AOC to do that is going to get Joe Manchin to do something? Like I said, you know, in a completely different conversation, when we were talking about, Manchin with Osita, like, you could get DSA, every single member of DSA, to occupy Joe Manchin's office, and he would cut a campaign commercial out of that. He wants to be seen. Like, if if AOC is representing something and Joe Manchin could vote against that, that's good for Joe Manchin. If AOC prevents the COVID review, you know, the relief bill from going forward, Joe Manchin's going to campaign on that. That's why I'm different. I'm not AOC. Jaboni, Sam, you've said before that Manchin wanted to be kingmaker. I think early on, at one point, there's something flipped with Joe Manchin. And I think it was when he realized, like, oh, this actually could actually happen, and I'm nervous about that. At one point, he was like, you know, $4 trillion infrastructure bill. And then I think at one point, he just decided, like, oops, I can't posture in this way. And I think he's, it's becoming clearer and clearer that he is that kid in the baseball.
Yeah. What I was trying to say, though, is like earlier, it's just that it's more, Lieberman loved being the firewall for the insurance industry, for Wall Street, whatever. Like, he relished that role.
But he also, you know, voted against, he was, you know, with McCain on the war. It wasn't just a specific.
And the war, yeah.
He wanted to be, to be the guy that people come to. That's what, like, this whole thing, like, I'm the guy who's going to come down and convince them to vote for DC statehood. He wants to be the guy in the middle. Manchin, it looks like, is afraid of being that guy.
Manchin's more interested. Yeah, he wants to be the guy in the middle, though, for a different purpose. He wants to be the one who says, okay, I'm going to make it a compromise so that he can put it in his
act. He wants to brand this way. But, I mean, Lieberman literally wanted to be the guy. It wasn't so much for a branding exercise for
him. I know. He was a fucking narcissist who was funded by a ton of.
Yeah, but he wanted to be interest. He wanted to be the this guy who does this. And Manchin has the opportunity to be that guy. He's afraid of it. Because he's afraid of it.
Well, he's also just not that bright.
I don't know. It doesn't take much. Like, how much do you need to know? Pharmaphil. Glad Benny finally knows what it's like to get hardwood. No wonder he doesn't know what a wet-ass P-word feels like. He double bags his hardwood. Okay. Nice. Lieberman loved nothing more than to be the deciding vote, says Jay Tingle. The first thing he did when he joined the Senate was to attempt to be the holdout in the vote to nominate John Tower, Secretary of Defense. Didn't work out that time. Chris Dodd voted for Tower as a sop because Tower had voted against censure for Thomas Dodd.
Do you think it's probably noticeable when you are something like the deciding vote, the amount of lobbying interest you get in that week? Like, is that like just the sort of feedback people are responding to?
Lieberman wanted to be on the Sunday talk shows every week, and he was. This got him on those talk shows. And I just don't, and Manchin wants to brand himself, but Manchin, at the end of the day, it's just like, it's the, you know, Lieberman wanted to be the guy who got the ball because it made him feel great. Manchin's just too afraid. Manchin is, and it's a different dynamic. Lieberman was in a blue state, and his brand wasn't necessarily being a maverick. It was just like, he wanted to be that guy. Midi Doctors, remember to remind everybody to hit the like button and subscribe. All right, I got to do four more of these and we're out. Tying to be Ben Kerr. Love Andy Kindler. Totally thought Andy's painting was Elvis, but better looking. Kid tested Paul Buer approved. Do these people really have nothing better to do with their time? I'm a total nerd and can't watch or think about a quarter of the TV shows and theme parks they cry about. Dolce Moche, clarifying my tech comments from Monday. Legislative fixes would open the door to competition, but the growth profit motive would lead to more of the same. I'm saying we can break the cycle by starting a collectivist approach and avoid the venture capitalist trap. Build from the start the right values. Rob from Dedham. I'm originally from the Cape, and when I was visiting my mom last summer, I saw Gutfield, assuming it was a stand-up show, sold out at the Yarmouth Drive-In, perfect entertainment for the retiree crowds. And the final I am of the day, Corey from Indianapolis. Well, this is for the week. My wife's coworker goes to Disney 4 to 8 times a year with her husband. They have no kids. I think y'all underestimate how obsessed with Disney some millennials are.
That is so weird.
Matt, Brendan, Emma, great job this week. We will see you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there.